All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, April 18th, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everyone. It is a chilly and cloudy 37 degrees and very damp here in upstate New York. And we actually got a little bit more white on the lawn overnight last night. So where do we leave off on Friday? We titled the show CRISPR Rampage, Mad Science Proteins, and Bastardized Biology. We looked at a lot of different things, specifically at engineering proteins and protein structures to be utilized in the human body and some of the things that they can do with them. And what was pretty interesting is that Camille, our listener Camille, hi Camille, sent me some excerpts from a book that she is reading titled Engines of Creation, The Coming Era of Nanotechnology. And this was a book originally published in 1986 by Eric Drexler. We've talked about Eric Drexler and heard interviews by him before. He is considered the father of nanotechnology. But she found a pretty interesting dot that connected, which I don't know, they'd mentioned a little bit, but they never mentioned Eric Drexler in any of the articles or research that I had been covering. Originally published in 1986, Eric Drexler's Engine of Creation laid the theoretical foundation for the modern field of nanotechnology and articulated the amazing possibilities and dangers associated with engineering at molecular scales. Unique for both its style and substance, the book is today recognized as a seminal work in nanotechnology and has earned Drexler the title of Father of Nanotechnology. So I want to cover just a little excerpt here. This might help make things very clear for everyone as to why proteins and mad science engineered proteins. We'd even read that they created proteins in the lab that had never been seen before on planet Earth. I want you to understand the level of manipulation that we are talking about. And this is very frightening. And they are able to utilize proteins to create what they call molecular machines. Molecular machines are considered nanotechnology because molecules are measured at the scale of nanometer. Chapter 1, Engines of Construction, as part of Engines of Creation. Protein engineering, very chapter one. This represents the first major step toward a more general capability for molecular engineering, which would allow us to structure matter atoms by atom. Coal and diamonds, sand and computer chips, cancer and healthy tissue. Throughout history, variations in the arrangement of atoms have distinguished the cheap from the cherished, the disease from the healthy, and arranged one way, atoms can make up soil, air, and water, but arranged another, they make up ripe strawberries. Arranged one way, they make up homes and fresh air, and arranged another, they make ash and smoke. Our ability to arrange atoms lies at the foundation of technology, and we have come far in our atom arranging, from chipping flint for arrowheads to machine aluminum for spaceships, and we take pride in our technology with our life-saving drugs and our desktop computers. Yet this is just the beginning, because our spacecraft are still crude, our computers are still stupid, and our molecules and our tissues still slide into disorder, first destroying health, then life itself. Now, I want to stop for a second just on those last two items, destroying health, and then life itself. Now, I wish I had some sort of atomic rejuvenator out there. I mean, this is literally what we are talking about. Stuff from the days of Star Trek, where you walked into a particle beam and it went and it remanipulated your DNA and your sequences to make you young and healthy again. And maybe someday that'll be there. I mean, we see them working on the beginnings of all these technologies. But on a personal note, you guys know, after 7 years, I love doing this show, and I love digging into this stuff and making connections and figuring out, like, what evil they're trying to cook up in the name of controlling everything on planet Earth. But it has taken a toll on me, not just the show, but running this network and having to always be on the clock, and my entire life has to be orchestrated around getting things cut, getting things in, doing research, getting the show done, you know, all the things go along with it. And it has really taken a toll on my physical health. You know, the last year I've been battling, trying to get back up the ladder, but it's been very difficult. And with this elongated winter that is happening right now, I'm having a lot of difficulty. My energy levels are in the toilet, and I feel achy all over, and I just don't feel energetic like my old self anymore. So I'm almost considering taking an extended vacation, maybe for the network anyway. You know, if I continue to do this show, I'm thinking maybe I'll just do it on an individualistic platform that'll probably be a whole lot cheaper and will allow me to just do things on a whim. But just a warning, because I don't think I can do this forever, and I know there were about 730 live episodes that I had done up until this point, and this last year has been really tough, so I just want to make a note of that so nobody is surprised the day that I decide to take my life back for a little while and focus on what I need to focus on, and that would be getting better. All right, so anyway, let's continue here. So like I said, I wish I had an atomic generator. So if anyone has one of those out there that they're working on, let me know. But for all of our advances in arranging atoms, we still use primitive methods. And with our present technology, we're still forced to handle atoms in unruly herds. But for the laws of nature, they leave plenty of room for progress, and the pressure of the world competition is even now pushing us forward. Watch out for China. And for better or for worse, the greatest technological breakthroughs in history are still to come. Our modern technology builds on ancient tradition. 30,000 years ago, chipping flint was high technology of the day, and our ancestors grasped stones containing trillions upon trillions of atoms, removing chips containing billions of trillions of atoms to make axe heads. And they made fine work with their skills that are difficult to imitate today. They also made patterns on cave walls in France with sprayed paint, using their hands as stencils, and later they made pots by baking clay, and then bronze by cooking rocks. They shaped bronze by pounding it, they made iron and steel, then they shaped it by heating and pounding and removing chips. And we now cook up pure ceramics and stronger steels, but we still shape them by pounding, chipping, and so forth. We cook up pure silicon, and we put it into slices. We make patterns onto its surface using tiny stencils and sprays of light. We call these products chips, and we consider them exquisitely small, at least in comparison to axe heads. Our microelectronic technology has managed to stuff machines as powerful as room-sized computers of the early 50s onto silicon chips in a pocket-sized computer, and engineers are now making even smaller devices, slinging herds of atoms at crystal surfaces to build up wires and components that are 1/10 of a width of a fine human hair. These microcircuits may be small by standards of flints, but each transistor holds trillions of atoms, and the so-called microcomputers are still visible to the naked eye. And by the standards of these newer, more powerful technologies, they actually will seem gargantuan. Microcircuits have parts measured in micrometers, that is, in 1/1,000,000th of a meter, but molecules are measured in nanometers, which is 1,000 times smaller. And we can use the term nanotechnology and molecular technology interchangeably to describe this new style of technology. The engineers of this new technology will build both nanocircuits and nanomachines. A dictionary definition of a machine is any system that is usually a rigid body formed and connected to an alter, transmit, and direct applied forces in a predetermined manner to accomplish a specific objective, such as the performance of useful work. Molecular machines fit this description quite well. To imagine these machines, one must first picture molecules. We can picture atoms as beads and molecules as clumps of beads, like child's beads linked by snaps. In fact, chemists do sometimes visualize molecules by building models from plastic beads. Think of them as a Tinker toy set. And atoms are round like beads, and although molecular bonds are not the snaps, our picture of at least captures the essential notion that bonds can be broken and reformed. And if an atom were the size of a small marble, a fairly complex molecule would be the size of your fist. And this makes a useful mental image, but atoms are really about 1/10,000th the size of a bacteria, and a bacteria is about 1/10,000th the size of a mosquito. Biochemists are already at work with these machines, which are chiefly made of proteins. Ding, 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 ding. And that was a long, winding path just to get to the sentence, which is the main engineering material of living cells. And these molecular machines have relatively few atoms, so they have lumpy surfaces like objects made by gluing together a handful of small marbles. Also, many pairs of atoms are linked by bonds that can bend or rotate, and so protein machines are unusually flexible. But like all machines, they have parts of different shapes and sizes that do useful work, and all machines use clumps of atoms as parts. Protein machines simply use very small clumps. Biochemists dream, and they are already tinkering with this, on designing and building such devices, but there are difficulties to overcome. Engineers use beams of light to project patterns onto silicon chips, but chemists must build much more indirectly than that. When they combine molecules in various sequences, they only have limited control over how the molecules join. And while biochemists need complex molecular machines, they still have to borrow from cells. Nevertheless, advanced molecular machines will eventually let them build nanocircuits and nanomachines as easily and directly as engineers now build microcircuits and washing machines. Then progress will become swift and dramatic. And one of the things that Camille had sent an excerpt of was the fact that Eric Drexler had been tinkering with proteins and folding them in different ways to come up with different little gears and things of that nature to make molecular machines. And he was one of the people that had solved one of the grand obstacles to protein engineering and molecular machine building. So I thought that was very interesting because he comes off as pretty concerned about humanity. I mean, he's very interested in cracking this nut, but I don't think he's really doing it in an evil way. But, you know, you always got to be careful about the way your work is used after the fact. And that's some of what we are going to look at here a little bit later, is how all these technologies, and remember these are all disruptive technologies, are going to tie together and not turn out too well necessarily for the human race. Genetic engineers are already showing the way. Ordinarily, when chemists make molecular chains called polymers, they dump molecules into a vessel where they bump and snap together haphazardly in a liquid. The resulting chains have varying lengths and the molecules are strung together in a particular order. But the modern gene synthesis machines, genetic engineers build more orderly polymers, specifically DNA molecules, by containing molecules in a particular order. These molecules are the nucleic acids of DNA, and that would be C, A, T, G, and maybe even X and Y if you're looking at synthetic DNA. And the genetic engineers don't dump them all in together, but instead they direct the machine to add different nucleotides in a particular sequence to spell out a particular message. And they actually have coding software that enables them to do that. So it's just a few clicks of a mouse, and you can build some DNA strands. And then you can 3D laser print it and get a high resolution copy. And even if you're working with DARPA and the Broad Institute, they have some DNA manufacturing that is going on as well. So they can mass produce these things. But instead, they direct the machine to add different nucleotides in a particular sequence to spell out a particular message. And they first bond one kind of nucleotide to the chain ends, then they wash away leftover material and add chemicals to prepare the chain ends to bond to the next nucleotide. They grow chains, and as the bonds on nucleotides grow one time in a programmed sequence, they anchor the very first nucleotide in each chain to a solid surface to keep the chain from washing away in the chemicals. In this way, they have a big clumsy machine and a cabinet to assemble specific molecular structures from parts of hundreds of millions of times smaller than itself. And this is absolutely crazy because these are called protein machines. These protein machines, called restriction enzymes, read certain DNA sequences to allow them to cut here, and they read these genetic patterns by touch, by sticking to them, and then they cut the chain by rearranging a few atoms. Other enzymes splice together, reading match parts as glue here, likewise, then stick there. And by using these gene machines, and I think we have CRISPR now, and by using these, remember this is 1986, and by using gene machines to write and the restricted enzymes to cut and paste, and I think Cas9 is an enzyme we read on Friday, genetic engineers can write and edit whatever DNA message they choose. But by itself, DNA is a fairly worthless molecule. It is neither strong like Kevlar, nor colorful like a dye, nor is it active like an enzyme, yet it is something that industry is prepared to spend billions of dollars to use. The ability to direct molecular machines called ribosomes. I haven't looked into ribosomes. In cells, molecular machines first transcribe DNA, copying its information to make RNA tapes. And then much as old numerically controlled machines shape metals based on instructions stored on tape, ribosomes build proteins based on instructions stored in RNA strands. And these proteins are useful. Proteins like DNA resemble strings of lumpy beads, but unlike DNA, protein molecules fold up to form small objects able to do things. And those would be molecular machines. Some are enzymes, machines that build up and tear down molecules, and other proteins are hormones binding to yet another protein to signal cells to change their behavior. Genetic engineers can produce these objects cheaply by directing the cheap and efficient molecular machinery inside of living organisms to do their work. Whereas engineers running a chemical plant must work with vats of reacting chemicals, engineers working with bacteria can make them absorb chemicals, carefully rearrange the atoms, and then store a product or release it into the fluid around them. Genetic engineers now have programmed bacteria to make proteins ranging from human growth hormone to renin, which is an enzyme used to make cheese. Pharmaceutical companies like Eli Lilly are now marketing Humulin, which is a human insulin molecule that is made by bacteria. So, all right, I guess you guys get the point. There was quite a number of pages, and I didn't mean to read that much, but it continues on. It is a really good book. I found the full PDF, so I will link to that in the notes if anyone is interested. But it is highly recommended, and it is written by Eric Drexler, the father of nanotech. So now let's take another step forward. I was reading a publication about a collaboration of groups that are working together on nanotechnology. And I ran across an institute that was at MIT that I'd never heard about before. It is called the Institute for Soldier Nanotechnologies. Now, you know, we've talked in the past about how when you're in the military, you basically sign your life away to be a guinea pig, and you can't refuse any of their vaccines that they say that you have to get, or their medical procedures that you need to get implanted to be a better soldier on the battlefield. They've been working for a very long time on the Super Soldier Project, and they'll be able to use nanosensors to be able to read your biostatistics while on the battlefield, tell whether or not you are under duress, maybe even push some buttons to get rid of those fear hormones, and maybe give you some adrenaline to make you aggressive, maybe push that dopamine button to get you to anticipate winning. There are even things that they have worked on to be able to embed sensors so you could see in high definition, infrared, be able to manipulate and control with the blink of an eye autonomous aerial vehicles and target a subject on the ground. Listen to this. What is the Institute for Soldier Nanotechnologies? Well, very good question. The Institute for Soldier Nanotechnologies is a team of MIT, Army, and industry partners working together to discover and field technologies that dramatically advance soldier protection and survivability capabilities. The team members collaborate on basic research to create new materials, devices, processes, and systems, and on applied research to transition promising results toward practical products useful for the soldier. The Army members of Team ISN, and that is Institute for Soldier Nanotechnologies, also give guidance on soldier protection and survivability needs and the relevancy of research proposed to address these needs. Army and industry partners share their expertise on how to convert promising outcomes of fundamental research into practical products that work in harmony with other soldier technologies, can you be even more vague, and which can be manufactured affordably in quantities needed for our soldiers. Now, this last sentence is the kicker. Moreover, these collaborations help identify dual-use applications for Institute of Soldier Nanotechnologies for firefighters, police officers, and other first responders, and indeed the civilian community at large. So doesn't that make you feel good? Because I know that really caught my attention. So their mission is not only to improve blast and ballistic protection, but also create new methods of detecting and detoxifying chemical and biological analytes, providing physiological monitoring and automated medical intervention, and enhancing situational awareness, all while decreasing equipment weight and increasing soldier comfort. So yes, did you hear that? Medical, physiological monitoring, and automated medical intervention. Release the nanobots. All right. So how crazy is that? So do we really want to read about why nanotechnology? Because we probably already know that. Well, let's take a look. Nanotechnology is the foundation for the Institute of Soldier Nanotechnologies research to provide unique opportunities for soldier protection. In particular, nanotech harnesses the size dependence of the physical and chemical phenomenon at tiny scales. And these sizes are truly minute. Theoretical and computational efforts complement experimental research programs and material synthesis in the integration in order to understand and optimize material properties. And one of the things that's so crazy about this is they use all this mumbo jumbo, but what they're really saying is it's all to keep you safe, people. So go back to sleep. We are authorizing our med science. We are doing in these labs, we are mixing and matching humans with other creatures, splicing and dicing the genome and proteins and ribosomes, and we are doing mass manufacturing of these things, figuring out ways to cure you and to monitor you to make sure that there is never any fake news or terrorists under your bed or in your closet or lurking in your bloodstream, because we will know about it. And if things go awry because of a rogue actor, we'll be able to turn back the clock with some of our other programs that we have been developing under our biological research program that really isn't officially happening. It's all being done in an offensive measure. Moreover, nanotechnology is inherently interdisciplinary, bringing together all of our children from all the universities to work toward ending humanity under the guise of keeping us safe. It is historically very different and allows innovators to capitalize on the unique features. So they're going to sell our kids' future. For example, ISN scientists are combining traditionally low cost and high production volumes of textile manufacturing with exquisitely custom electronic properties, typically achieved via the expensive processing of semiconductors. The potential impact is a unique optoelectronic fibers for full body coverage of soldiers. These are the ultimate wearables, people. Coverage of soldiers, buildings, and vehicles that will allow them to detect heat, light, sound, and all of which could be made possibly by the ability to produce these fibers at speeds, costs, and quantities expected for mass production of textile fibers. Now, by including wearables everywhere on the battlefield, what does that give us? Well, this is another story. April 11th, 2018. Get ready for the Internet of Battle Things, warns U.S. Army AI Buffin. Future wars will be fought with physical and cyber robots. The U.S. Army researchers believe that war will be fought with human soldiers commanding a team of physical and cyber robots and wearables everywhere, the Internet of Battle Things, to create a network of Internet Battle Things in the future. The Internet of Intelligent Battle Things, more affectionately known as the IOBT, is the emerging reality of warfare. As AI and machine learning advances, says Alexander Kutt, chief of the Network Science Division of the U.S. Army Research Laboratory. He envisions a future where physical robots are able to fly, crawl, walk, or ride into battle. And the robots can be small as an insect and be used as sensors such as robo-bees and ones that are as large as a vehicle that are carrying troops and supplies. There will also be cyber robots, basically ghosts in a machine, autonomous programs used within computers and networks to protect communications, fact-checking, relaying information, and protection of other electronic devices from enemy malware. In order to be protective in performing these functions, battle things will have to collaborate with each other, with also human warfighters as well. And this will require a significant degree of autonomous self-organization, such as swarms, and also accepting a variety of relations between things and humans, says Kutt in a research paper to be released at the proceedings of the Spring Symposium of the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence. Kutt's ideas rest in the assumption that countries have obeyed a ban on autonomous weapons beyond meaningful control, and so humans will still ultimately lead and make decisions on the battlefield, whilst the IOBT devices will mainly act as aids. The plan relies on AI and machine learning advancing to capabilities beyond what is currently achievable, and neural networks are good at learning patterns and data for tasks such as image recognition or language translation, and they can achieve a high accuracy level, but it also requires millions of training samples. The battlefield, however, is volatile and a dynamic environment, and the IBOT, that is the Internet of Battle Things, will have to adapt to changing tactics and learn from a small number of data sets that will be imperfect, unlabeled, and potentially even deceptive. So, i.e., be prepared for a lot more cannon fodder in the civilian landscape. Samples might be video footage or camera feeds showing the local environment for robots. And machine learning algorithms will have to determine what features are important to focus on. For example, piles of rubble are probably irrelevant. but such systems should be able to see if there was a wounded ally buried among the debris. Deep learning systems are often inefficient and rely on copious amounts of computing power to crunch through numbers, and the hardware of the Internet of Battle Things will have to be small and light to fit into tiny sensors and robots that consume as little energy as possible. One might suggest that a way to overcome such limitations on computing resources available is to offload the computations via wireless communications, maybe even 5G, to a powerful computing resource located outside of the battlefield, maybe even on satellite. But unfortunately, this isn't yet a viable solution because the enemy's inevitable interference with friendly networks will limit the opportunities for use of a reach-back computational resource. A third key area is communication between the humans and robots, like an ad hoc network, and questions and answers are used to test knowledge in natural language processing, but it also works well when machines are trained with huge amounts of text like IBM's Watson. But to survive, the Internet of Battle Things will actually understand commands and engage in useful dialogues rather than by simply memorizing and recalling bits of information. Oh, calling Agent X, Coate explains that it will require agents that are able to follow conversations and have general common sense and reasoning skills, something that today's chatbots like Tay actually lack, and there are significant gaps that must be filled in our knowledge of AI in order to apply them broadly and effectively, as well as safely, within a complex domain of human endeavors. It is important to make use of recent advances in AI in certain types of tasks for which today's AI is well suited, but it's also important to recognize those tasks where AI is not yet ready for robust applications. The U.S. Army has invested in the Distributed and Collaborative Intelligence Systems, more affectionately known as the DCISD, and the Collaborative Research Alliance, more affectionately known as the CRA. Both programs aim to excel the Internet of Battle Things research in a joint effort with U.S. universities, probably such as MIT. But the recent revelation into Google's government contract with the Pentagon, and I have that story queued up next, highlights the gap in the U.S. Army's AI workforce, and it is relying now on Google employees to help use Google's TensorFlow API to analyze its drone footage using computer vision. At a recent Senate hearing, General Paul Nekasone, currently the commander of the U.S. State's Army Cyber Command, admitted that artificial intelligence engineers are scarce. He said, Coate says, indeed, it is a challenge for the Army to compete for talent with Silicon Valley and actually with many places that have a great high-tech entrepreneurship, but it is a good challenge to have, and it keeps us on our toes competing for the best people. We are lucky that there are so many brilliant scientists and engineers and that they are patriotic and proud, oh yes, to serve in the defense of our society and the takeover of our future. And they are excited to work on challenging problems of the Army's technology. And we augment the talents of our government scientists by working closely with academia and businesses, putting our slimy tentacles into every walk of life. And we find many companies, large and small, who are very interested in working with us. Well, so there you have it. So what about Google working with the Pentagon? Well, let's look at that quick, because I did have that queued up. This is April 4th, 2018, out of TheVerge.com. Google employees demand that the company pull out of the Pentagon AI project. Google should not be in the business of war. Last month, it was revealed that Google was offering its resources to the U.S. Department of Defense for Project Maven, which is a research initiative to develop computer vision algorithms that can analyze drone footage. In response to more than 3,100 Google employees that signed a letter urging Google CEO Sundar Pichai to reevaluate the company's involvement, as Google should not be in the business of war, as reported by the New York Times. The work on Project Maven began last April, and while the details of what Google is actually providing the DoD are not clear, of course it isn't. It is. Remember, I aired a rebroad of a show that had talked about some of those Google broadcasting stations and the frequencies that they were getting permission from the FCC for, and the entire thing was basically redacted. So that's how it kind of goes. It is understood that it is a Pentagon research initiative for improved analysis of drone footage, and in a press statement, a Google spokesman confirmed that the company is giving the DoD access to its open source TensorFlow software. Well, that kind of is curious since it is open source to begin with, so they could just take it. But maybe they're giving them help with engineers as well. Used in machine learning applications that are capable of understanding the contents of photos. Google has described its work on Project Maven as non-offensive. Maybe that means then it's defensive. And Diane Greene, the head of Google's cloud operation, who sits on Alphabet's board of directors, said that the technology will not be used to operate or fly drones, and it will not be used to launch weapons. Well, whew! But that's really scary coming from a corporation that is a behemoth like Google, by the way. So it's not going to be used to launch weapons. But remember, Google is not evil. So said their tagline of the 90s. But it is not enough for many employees who signed this letter addressed to Pichai. And while this eliminates a narrow set of direct applications, the letter reads, quote, the technology is being built for the military, and once it is delivered, it could easily be used to assist in these tasks in the future. The letter goes on to ask that Google stop its involvement in Project Maven and that the company create and enforce a policy stating that it will not be evil and it will not engage in building warfare technology. Well, I think that is a pretty, what's the word I'm looking for? And they're not going off the deep end. I think I would have to agree with them, and I would ink my name to that letter as well. This contract puts Google's reputation at risk, and it stands in direct opposition to our core values, the letter states. Building this technology to assist the U.S. government in military surveillance and a potentially lethal outcomes is not acceptable. And I'm going to echo that feeling. Google's spokesman issued a response to this letter on Tuesday, and it reports that the New York Times states that any military use of machine learning naturally raises valid concerns. We are actively engaged across the company in a comprehensive discussion of this very important topic. Additionally, but if they offer us enough money, we might change our minds. And the technology is used, I added that myself, the technology is used to flag images for human review, and it is intended to save lives, of course, wink, and to save people from having to do highly tedious work, reads Google's official statement. Other companies, such as, of course, Amazon and Microsoft, have also worked on defensive projects. But the Google employees backing this letter do not see this as a way to endorse Google's work on Project Maven. Google's unique history and its motto, and like I said, don't be evil. And that is back when I worked in the tech industry. That was their original motto, was don't be evil. And I used to joke, like, why would they even say that? But it is true. Its motto, don't be evil, and its direct reach into the lives of billions of users across the globe set it apart, the letter states. And in the past, Google has been careful about ties to military research, even though it has DARPA employees that have come work for it in the past, such as DARPA Dan and Regina Duggan. It has rejected funds from the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency in the past after buying up a string of robotics companies with ties to the military research organization. So that's a pretty good story there. Thank you, Verge. So now where do we go from here? So Google, artificial intelligence, selling it to the Pentagon, nanotechnology divisions within MIT. Well, it can't get any worse than that, can it? Well, maybe. This is out of The Nation. This is the Taiwanese version. It is the portal, but it is linked to the Wall Street Journal. Asking the question today, April 18th, 2018, should we be worried about artificial intelligence? You know, is Juul a lunatic? Well, maybe. Just maybe. But maybe not, people. I'll tell you, it's been 30 years since I told my dad one day, we were sitting downstairs having a few beers, that one day, and don't ask me how or where this even came from, but it was in conversation, one day I will be able to tell the world that it is coming. I didn't know what it was. I had no idea what I was talking about. I didn't even have any idea because there wasn't any technology back then except for writing to be able to tell the world about anything. Because you couldn't be a Walter Cronkite back in 1988. But here we are talking about our not too distant future. And guys, there's no way to stop this. It is all coming from down on high. And it is infecting us like a virus. And they're dangling that dopamine carrot to get us all to buy into the technology that pushes those buttons that allows them to bag, tag, and track. And infect once they get it inside of you. There is no escape. Should we be worried about artificial intelligence? So have another cup of coffee. Let's go. Yes, very much so. According to the participants of a recent Bangkok seminar on the subject. Well, what should we do about it then? Well, very good question. And that answer is not clear because simply nobody knows for sure how far and how fast this technology will go. I'm telling you, it's consuming us and our planet to recreate it in someone else's image with nano sensors to be able to paint in the dashboard and to monitor, bag and tag, and fix anything that is operating outside of perimeters. We don't need knowledge of rocket science to be alarmed. Well, good thing about that. Self-driving cars will put human cabbies and chauffeurs out of work, and journalists face even a more immediate threat by the fake news and the hate speech algorithms that they are launching, with algorithms already writing news stories from the information that it gathers online. The seminar in Bangkok also showcased robots that can care for elderly patients, and I bet those were from Japan. Or they are also able to inform their children or doctors if their patients refuse to take their pills. So we got little Stitch robots too. Other robots can serve food and drinks and take orders at restaurants. They can also cook, and they can work on flights as well, rendering stewards and stewardesses redundant or even obsolete. Basically, almost every single human job is threatened, experts at this recent seminar confirmed, and robotic nurses can become doctors in no time. So they're like the Swiss Army knife. And will autonomous chefs replace the kitchen someday? Well, you bet it. And even the ghost in the machine reporters can easily become editors writing analyses with unrivaled accuracy and objectivity. Artificial intelligence is already around it, and the autopilot controls your aircraft on takeoff and on landing. And when your engine blows out and sucks passengers out windows, the human pilots are merely bystanders monitoring these machines. Car factories have long since swapped humans for robotic precision, efficiency, and productivity, and that was something that my father saw firsthand, and it started in like the 80s even, if you can believe it. And Google knows what you are looking for even before you finish the thought you were typing. Computers have beaten the world best chess and Go players, and last but not least, most of us are glued by the dopamine carrot that sucks us into our very own small piece of AI for large parts of the day. And these are just the primitive beginnings, and you have to remember that. Imagine what our children's lives are going to be like, people. And you can already see it as schools are forcing these machines into these children's lives and requiring them to acquire an addiction to the machine. Because every day at 4 o'clock, they get to run down the hall, lock themselves in their room because they, quote unquote, got to do their homework. And if you try to get in the way of that, it becomes a battle where they actually turn into these little creatures that are very aggressive and nasty and horrible, people that you've never seen before. I'm telling you guys, this is a very insidious way to get into our lives. They are grooming these kids. They are allowing their brains to prune neurons to make this an addiction. And even with your smartphone and your devices that we deal with on a daily basis, they are robbing us of our interactions with society around us to want the machine more than our daily lives. It's just really awful how this is happening. And these are just the primitive beginnings, the story says. Artificial intelligence is sweeping across the world in more and more forms and at many, many levels. One of the scariest things about the AI revolution is that its capabilities are being updated all the time. Every day your device updates, meaning yesterday's marvels are quickly becoming routine and quote-unquote invisible. Simply put, robots taking our orders at restaurants will no longer be considered artificially intelligent once every child's doll can do the same and more. Or you can order online and then go pick it up or have it delivered via drone in 20 minutes or less. It is probably better to focus solely on the short term and let future generations worry about, say, whether the world should have its first robot prime minister for president. And remember, we talked about that before. I think that the debacle of the elections and the quote-unquote Russian intervention and the swaying of our puny human opinions is going to move along our quote-unquote government of the future and make it better run by something that isn't swayed by emotions like an artificial intelligence. But we'll leave that one for 2020 and beyond. But while human politicians are safe for now, already under threat are insurance underwriters, financial analysts, bank employees, journalists, cab drivers, farm and factory workers, inventory managers, stock handlers, retail workers, and lawyers, and oncologists, and radiological readers. I don't know, I'll add more. We've covered so many. Even movie stars aren't safe, or film editors, or anything like that. AI has already resurrected dead actors like Peter Cushing and Carrie Fisher in the film Rogue One. And as it advances, it'll generate longer scenes with beloved stars of the past, making it harder and harder for new actors and actresses to break into the spotlight. How weirdo would that be? And it will feel good at the beginning, one participant at the seminar said. Artificially intelligent labor will initially solve the problems of manpower shortages, and AI in the filmmaking industry will be an audience-pleasing moneymaker, and so on. And various illusions of convenience will then lure humans into speeding up their own downfall, going down the downward spiral. And if you've never heard that album by Nine Inch Nails, I highly recommend it. It is pretty depressing, but it is a great album, Downward Spiral. Or maybe down the spiral. I think there's a few of them. It would be like eating delicious but unhealthy foods that clog our arteries. And we will not realize the danger until it is too late. It is the poison apple, people. Don't let the robots feed you grapes and give you massages in your utopia. Because they will take down, as Frank Zappa said, they'll take down the backsplash and all of the decorations, and you're going to see that it's just a brick wall and it will be your jail. None of the participants said that we should do to prepare ourselves for the day when AI jumps from the primitive stage to something more sophisticated. The closest thing they came to was a vague quote, humans need to adapt themselves. Well, of course, nobody said how. Well, get your DNA upgrades and your protein nanobots. What we can do that is superior to what a truly smart computer or machine would be capable of. Well, I don't know. Elon Musk talked about merging with the machine as being the only way to compete. And right now, we can still compose better songs, maybe for a little while, and better books. But that is only because AI is still in diapers. However, we may not have to worry so much. Going with the flow and channeling it has always been a key strength of humankind. Yes, so put a little sprinkle of sugar on it. And moreover, the seminar tackled the issue of job losses with an unspoken assumption that money, and there'll be universal basic income, like Kurzweil said, will be a worldwide thing by 2030. And it will remain just as important when AI does much of the work. Such an assumption might be misguided. Maybe joblessness won't be that bad, as money comes to play less of a role in our lives when AI takes over all of our tasks in greater numbers and there is ending diversity and equality for everybody. And I don't remember what they call that. I don't know. There's a word for that where there's no more wanting food or heat or living quarters because it's all taken care of. Because it all requires no salary and it will all be free. Remember, there is no free lunch. There is another potential outcome that is worth considering, though. Perhaps we human ourselves qualify as a high form of artificial intelligence. And flesh and blood operating systems equipped with complex sensory features that produce feelings, emotions, and thus self-awareness, reproducing its own AI that one day become more smarter than itself. And maybe we are thus not a cause for worry. Well, I don't know about that. I think he paints a pretty interesting picture. So now where do we go? Let's take a look, because I mentioned Ray Kurzweil. I don't know, I'm running out of time here. Ray Kurzweil says universal basic income will arrive in the 2030s. Kurzweil predicted Friday, last week, that universal basic income will be common throughout the developed world by the early 2030s and globally by the end of that decade. Speaking at the TED conference in Vancouver this week, Kurzweil said that people actually have more than their fundamental needs met through universal basic income. He says that you'll be able to live very well on that because money just rains from the sky. Interestingly enough, the day Kurzweil picks for the advent of universal basic income is right about the same time he sees the AI takeover around 2029. Guys, that's just 11 years from now. He predicts that AI will pass the Turing test, and that is a panel of human judges will not be able to tell whether or not they are conversing with a human or a computer. In the 2030s, he says, we will merge with intelligent technology we are creating. So now come the nanobots. He says the human neocortex will connect with cloud-based intelligence, with nanobots in our brains, and we will have an indefinite expansion of our neocortex, and we can live in a swarm-based world. He says that it will lead to new forms of expression, such as writing music, writing poetry, and it will be as different from today's communication as current human expression is from that of primates. And how we in the U.S. and other countries would pay for this universal basic income, given our large deficits, Kurzweil predicts a massive deflation that will make all the goods cheaper. And separately, Kurzweil debuted a new Google project called Talk to Books, which is a free tool that answers users' questions by finding the best answer for more than 100,000 books. And it is, unlike traditional research, it is based on semantics and not keywords. Well, that's kind of a neat detail, but how does that get around universal basic income? Here's another story that I ran across yesterday titled Smart Robots. So let's give the world to smart robots, artificial intelligence, the war machine. Smart robots that are in our lives and in our homes and in the battlefields. And with our security forces, our police force, our environment to monitor things, prove stupidly easy to hack for spying and murder. Now, we've talked about killer sex bots before. Let's look at the rest of the smart robots in the 21st century. Your plastic pal, who is psychotic. Robots are increasingly common in the 21st century, both on the factory floor and in the home. However, it appears that security systems are anything but modern and high-tech. In March, IO Interactive released partial research showing that hacking a variety of industrial and home robotic systems wasn't all that difficult. Now, after vendors have been busy patching, they're showing how it is done and the potentially lethal consequences. When it comes to causing serious damage, industrial robots have the biggest potential for harm. They are weighty beasts with the ability to hit fleshy humans very hard if so programmed. Researchers also found with access to factory networks, these kinds of systems were trivially easy to hack. They are automating systems across the globe. For example, systems from Universal Robots were vulnerable in a variety of ways. Simple stack-based buffer overflow conditions would allow new code to be injected into the robot's systems, and a key part of the operating system had absolutely no authentication control at all on the robot's movements. Units had static SSH host keys that left them open to man-in-the-middle attacks, just like they used to have on routers. And it is unlike that anyone would be bonkers enough to hack this robot and try to harm people, because they are static and you have to make them flail around like Trump mocking a disabled reporter. But for the smarter hacker out there, there's a host of possibilities for these kinds of attacks. For example, imagine Stuxnet malware and how it temporarily crippled Iran's nuclear centrifuges by messing with speed controls in the machinery and hiding this from the controllers. Now imagine something similar in an arms factory instructing robots to make tiny but important changes to their tanks that could cripple the end product, underboring the size of a tank barrel, for example. And alternately, a cunning hacker could have these now patched flaws to shut down the full production floor. And if they had shorted the stock of the target company, the ensuing loss and the knock-on effects could prove very devastating. Then you have the spy inside your homes. While the industrial side of things could make things expensive, it turned out that home robots also have major issues, particularly with the apps that control them. They allowed them to have fun making the UB Tech Alpha 2 a little stabby, so they made stabby robots at home. Oh, my God. Admittedly, that is not going to do anyone harm unless they are immobilized and very thin-skinned because the robot is too clumsy and slow, but still, they made them stabby. And the Alpha 2 and similar house robots like SoftBank's robotic Peppa, we've talked about Peppa before, and the NAO designs are loaded with microphones and cameras that could allow a hacker visual access to your home. The chief programs, and remember this Xbox too. Oh no, maybe I didn't turn on my music, or maybe I'm ahead here on this computer. The chief problems with these robots was a lack of code signing protection, and some of the mobile apps that control these devices proved either easy for men in the middles to alter or to allow remote control access. No, I think my clock is just a little behind. Looks like about 2 minutes. All right, so let's go one more step. So now we have all these hackable machines. Well, now Europe, and this was a new story, Europe is questioning whether or not to allow robots personhood, and they are very divided.